Well, hello again, everybody, and welcome back to X-Files Diaries. I'm Annie.
I'm Jen.
And today, we got to sit down and talk to the author of the new X-Files amazing, amazing book that is called The X-Files, The Official Archives, Cryptids, Biological Anomalies, and Parapsychic Phenomena. Paul Terry sat down with us, and we had a great interview with him. But before we air the interview, or air my old-timey speak, before we play the interview for you guys, I wanted to talk about something pretty cool that happened to me last week. Jen, do you know what that is?
I do. I think that maybe you had like a little just friendly sort of chitty-chatty time with one Gillian Anderson.
I did.
You just, you know, just hanging out on a Saturday chatting with Gillian Anderson.
Well, it was pretty cool. I'm never going to do a con again, decided in the midst of a pandemic that she was going to participate in a con. Put that on my 2020 bingo card. I was not expecting that at all. But she was, it was like you could essentially purchase 2 minutes, which sounds like not very much, but I got to tell you, I think it's a hell of a lot more time than you get with anyone at a con. If you've ever been to a con, you're getting shoved and your people are taking up your time and there's no time for anyone to focus on anything. So,
I think that those 2 minute chats are great because all you're doing is chatting.
Yeah.
She's not trying to sign something at the same time. There's not 100 people around you. You're getting your 2 minutes, which is great.
Yeah. Yeah. It was just really kind of, it was really cool. I was like nervous, but at the same time, she made me feel very relaxed. She was very sweet and nice. I'm going to play not the whole thing. I'm just going to play a little part of it for you guys because, you know, some of it was very personal to me. But the other part of it was something that I do believe is of interest to some of you guys, some of the fans. So here, I'm going to play it for you.
Right.
I wanted to ask you a question because, of course, everyone is sharing their videos. And I saw that you were wearing like a gray hooded sweatshirt that looked a little familiar. Is that the same sweatshirt from the X-Files finale? Did you steal that? You did.
No, I didn't steal it. They gave it to me. I was allowed to keep some of Scully's clothes, or at least one doubles of things. You know, when things were doubles, and this is one of the ones that I kept.
Well, that's awesome. It looks very cozy.
It's so cozy. It's so cozy. And for some reason, it doesn't pill like a lot of other things, considering how much I wear it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So the gray hoodie, you know which gray hoodie, right, Jen?
Yeah. We know which gray hoodie.
We see her in it all the time. And I don't know if you follow her. I'm sure you do on Instagram and Twitter or any of that. But she's constantly wearing this gray sweatshirt. And I feel like a lot of people on Twitter have been like, that looks like the sweatshirt from My Struggle For It. I did not.
I remember sort of like speculating about this in the past.
Yeah, people have speculated, but I don't think anyone has actually asked. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to ask her because she was wearing that sweatshirt.
She was wearing it
in the Zoom call, and I did not mention that I had noticed that she had been wearing it several times in the past, but I think she knew that I knew because she was like, yeah, it's really great considering how much I wear it. Like, I wanted to be like, oh, Gillian, I know. But it was really, really fun, and she was really sweet, and we had a really nice time. And when I hung up, I was like, wow, you know how you walk away from some celebrity encounters and you're just kind of like, oh, well, I didn't really like that or whatever. It didn't go over exactly how I imagined it.
Yeah.
And I did admittedly have some X-Files questions that I wanted to ask that I decided at the last second not to, because I just didn't want to make her think too hard in 2 minutes, you know, and I didn't want to make it come across like, hey, I'm grilling you. So instead, we just had a really nice conversation and it was cool. Would recommend 10 out of 10. If you can, pony up the dough to have this 2 minute experience with like some sort of celebrity during this pandemic time, especially, I highly recommend it because it was a really memorable experience. And, you know, thanks, Gillian, for taking out the time to talk to your fans. I mean, it was just a really cool thing to do. So,
yeah, that was awesome. There was obviously a lot of fans on Twitter that day who had the same experience, who also had chats with Gillian. It was great to see everyone's different experiences and how much fun everyone had. And it was just a really awesome day for folks to sort of share stories about their experience. And It's always great when, I mean, it's just almost like a religious experience for me when I get to sort of talk to one of these awesome people. So
yeah,
I think it's great. I think it's amazing that, I mean, she must have had a lot of people to talk to that day because they were taking a lot of time slots for these 2 minute
yeah.
chats.
And she did it.
Pack a lot in.
It was all weekend too. It's like she did it Saturday and Sunday. And so like that was like right. her entire weekend was spent doing this.
I think it's amazing. I mean, she obviously from some of the screenshots I saw, it looked a little tired, but still yeah. just kind of like it's, but not grouchy tired, just really like chill tired.
Very chill.
And still yeah. like, you know, friendly and warm. And I think that's amazing. I would be done after half an hour of that if it was me. I'm such an introvert that it would be like, I'd be so exhausted from talking to people. So I give her all the props for taking the time to do that.
Yeah, it was funny though because yeah, I was watching the videos kind of come up as people were posting them and yeah. she did look kind of sleepy and I was like, oh my God, because mine was later in the day. I was like, by the time she gets to me, she's going to be completely passed out or delirious. I was like hoping for delirious and so were you from what I recall.
Yeah, I was.
But I think that she had some coffee or something because by the time mine came up, I feel like she had her second wind and she was very... Yeah. Yeah, she was just very gracious and actively listening, which I appreciated. And yeah, it was just a really nice chat. And if you guys, any of you guys who haven't already shared, got to talk to Jillian, like, you know, let us know how your experience was at XFD Podcast. Mm-hmm. Or, I mean, they had chats with, I think, Annabeth, and they had chats, I think, with the Lone Gunman. I think they had several different X-Files actors yeah. and actresses. So
yeah, so yeah, if you had chats with any of them, I'd love to hear about them.
Yeah, if they said anything cool or if you got any cool info mm-hmm. out of anyone, yeah, let us know. We
just
would love to hear
like.
It. Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, that was a fun little detour, and now we're going to play our amazing interview with Paul Terry. I think what the first thing we want to ask you is, how did you become attached to this project? Like, were you approached or did you approach Chris, or how did this all come about?
This was the kind of perfect lifelong fan favorite show of all time pitch, essentially. So just like you guys, when season 10 was announced in 2015, about a week after that announcement, I contacted a friend of mine, a contact at Fox. And this idea had been sort of rolling around in my head for a little bit. But when the season 10 was firmly announced, it's coming back, I thought, I've got to do this book pitch, haven't I? So mm-hmm. I contacted him and I said, I've got a book idea and it's The X-Files. And he was like, oh, what is it? I said, it's The X-Files. And, it, as always, when you sort of say something in that way, it takes a second. But and then he got it and went, oh. Oh, yeah. OK, the actual case files. It should be an in-world book, completely in-world. Should never break that rule. I said, he knew it was my favorite show of all time. And I said, can you imagine what the fans' reaction would be if we presented them the actual case files from the show and all the paper props that you see on camera and all that stuff? And he was on board. And in principle, he was on board. And what happens with any project like this is that you have to find a publisher who is as excited as you are and maybe someone at the license is excited about it. So it was, shall we say, flirted with by a couple of other publishers between the years of sort of mid 2015 to end of 2016, early 2017. And then it was actually the end of 2017 when Abrams Books, thank goodness, wanted to do this book because they are absolutely the right partners. As you've seen with the book,
it's beautiful.
Park. So yay Abrams.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously you are a huge fan. I mean, the love for the show, it just comes out of every single page. And I have to tell you, Jen and I have had a chance to look at it. Jen has the e-copy, but I have the actual copy, which I purchased.
I have the actual copy now, too.
Oh, you have it now, too? Great.
Yeah, I had to get the real thing because the tactile nature of it demands. You can't, yeah. The e-book does not do it justice. You need the real deal.
Yeah. You should know, though, these books were purchased before we even attempted to contact you. So we are hardcore fans. But
Thank you so much.
Yeah, yeah. It is a beautiful book. The publishing, they did a great job. I mean, it looks fantastic. But before we get into the actual book, I want to hear about your relationship with The X-Files. How did you start loving the show? When did you get into it? You know, all that fun stuff.
So we've got to go back to school days, of course. So, you know, I'm a teenager in England, loving all nerdy science fiction things, you know, my whole childhood into my teenagedom. So things like, do you remember V, the original series about the lizard people? So, you know, that stuff was in the 80s. And then, you know, reruns of old things. Like, I always loved things like The Quatermass and The Pit, you know, Nigel Neal stories of science fiction, British science fiction. Mm-hmm. And then into the early 90s, things like Twin Peaks blew my mind. You know, the storytelling that takes you through all these different genres and subgenres in a way.
I should say, I recently got into Twin Peaks. I should say but it's phenomenal. Yeah. Sorry, yeah, continue. Phenomenal. But I just had to I had to share that.
Yeah, hey, I watched it back in the day.
Yeah, new and old and alike and lifelong Twin Peaks fans are always, you know, welcome for conversation. Yeah. So I think I was primed for a show like The X-Files anyway. And so loving, you know, UFO as a phenomena and, you know, or anything that's paranormal and unexplained. Because I was that kid at school who didn't believe everything was fully explained. So I was always that annoying kid putting my hand up going, no, but can we talk about that? Sciences. Now, that's really interesting. You know, my favorite phrase of all time in science classes was, well, this is an accepted theory, so write it down and move along. And I was fascinated by that idea that it's not 100% proven.
Oh, right. Really
anyway, right. So I'm digressing. But so the BBC were trailering and teasing this show called The X-Files and teasing what it was. And I'm sure you guys remember the early promos, all that shadow play and the torches and the intrigue and the woods and stuff from the pilot. And the just the insinuation of what the show was, myself and my mum was a huge, you know, fan of horror and sci-fi. And we just went, okay, well, it was a thing called the Radio Times and TV Times in England. It was like a TV guide. And so circled that like you had to in the day.
Yeah.
and then I can still remember the night we tuned in, you know, all the lights were turned out apart from a low light tune in, and it was from that pilot just hooked. And I think I'm correct in remembering that we actually got it about almost a year later than the US, because back in the 90s it wasn't like it is now where, you know, TV shows are all dumped on the same streaming platforms. I think the BBC did have the rights to it and broadcast it on BBC Two in sort of September 94. Whereas the show actually began in 93 in the US. So I promise listeners I was there from the start.
Wow. You sure were, yeah. You actually have both of us beat. I got into it halfway through the first season, so I actually wasn't there from the very beginning. So
I was pretty much the same, though.
It's close, but you really were there at the beginning.
Yeah, and I unfortunately did not yet come in until much later, Paul. Much, 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 much later.
You were still in on it during the original run, though, Annie.
I was. So. I got in my college years was when season 8 was going. And I got into it in season 8, if you can believe it.
But you know what? I'm here every day of the week for love and conversation for season 8.
Yes.
I'm a huge fan of season 8. I don't understand, you know, not to digress, but I don't understand the kind of, there's a fandom, aspects of the fandom that really don't like it at all as a piece. Mm. And I can remember with friends going, this is like one big movie. This is one huge story of where the hell's Mulder? How do we get him? And stuff.
Yeah. So,
I love season 8. Big love season 8.
You get no arguments from us
There's
on that.
There's no such thing as a digression. This is a podcast about the X-Files. So.
You should hear some of the digressions we wind up on. And you know what? It all winds up staying in there because it's all interesting. You just never know what little digression will be the most sort of like memorable part. So feel free to digress.
Well, you're talking to two people who appreciate season 8. So no worries about that. But speaking of digression, though, I was perusing your site, and I noticed, I just wanted to bring up really quickly that you're actually a music composer. That's really cool. I was looking through all this. So you compose music for what, television and things like that?
For soundtracks broadly, for whatever the project requires, if it's if it's film, if it's a documentary. In recent years, you know, the podcasting, as you guys know, running a podcast has really evolved. And I've done a lot of scoring, original scoring for podcast sort of audio docu-series.
Yeah.
And that's a really interesting way of scoring, because you're kind of, you know, when you're scoring to picture, you're inspired by the emotions that are developing on the screen in front of you. Whereas a podcast docu-series, you're inspired by the stories being told or the host, how he's telling the narration, if it's about the history of Batman or whatever it is. So, I've been scoring for a long time, and it goes back to, I think, you know, when you find your groove as a kid, especially as a teenager, of what you want to do. And I got really obsessed with the idea of figuring out how to write songs and music. and at the same time always loved creative writing. And I think those two paths, I never really understood why they couldn't both be parallel. You know, and sometimes you get that sense from, you know, from friends or family that, well, pick a path, you know, pick your career. And I've always seen the creative arts as very sort of amorphous and malleable, and they all kind of intermingle anyway. So the disciplines I would describe as are actually very similar in terms of pitching a book and then crafting a book. And the discipline required with that is very similar to writing music, because there's things like deadlines and schedules and booking things for interviews or musicians. So, yeah, I always use the phrase, if I'm not writing books, I'm writing music. And if I'm not busy writing music, I'm writing a book. So
Well, that's cool. And I've never really thought about that before, but you're right. Like, the actual crafting of those things are very similar. And I'm also a bit of a score junkie. I am a huge nerd for film score. Can I ask, like, what's your favorite film score? Something maybe that I haven't heard of or haven't, might not be super familiar with.
Oh, man. I have so many that are inspiring. But the one that I always say in an answer like this, because it always just gets me straight away, is the opening cue on the soundtrack, is Clint Mansell's The Fountain.
He did he did Requiem for a Dream too, correct?
He did, correct. Yeah. So
that Vox Eterna or whatever, that's intense. I'm gonna type The Fountain up and look that
there's
up.
There's something about the way that music moves in that movie, and I love that film to death. I think it's a really beautiful film. And that there's something about the soundtrack that also exists on its own. I love scores that can do that. Mm. And so it's regularly, you know, the vinyl's regularly put on in my house. And it's just a very inspiring collection of movements. And I was very lucky to see Clint Mansell perform some cues from it live a few years back at the Ace, actually, which is crazy good. But so many great contemporary composers, and also the classics, which are very inspiring. But I'm really inspired and motivated by the composers who do that thing where they really are scoring the emotionality on the screen, and they are literally underpinning and pushing that story forward. I get a kick out of that stuff.
So back to the X-Files book, Paul, how did you get in contact? So you're obviously, your agent or the publisher gave you the go-ahead, and you obviously had to get permission from Chris Carter and all of these people to actually dig into these quote-unquote files. How did that conversation come about, and were you able to work closely with him on this?
Well, yeah, so it's a little bit sort of unusual how this project worked, because as you were saying at the beginning, actually pitching an idea, it's not that common in terms of, a lot of times publishers come to writers and say, we've got the license for this show or this film, and we're thinking of doing a time making of or an art of for when the film comes out. So for legacy property, it's a little bit more unusual. So yeah, I pitched to Fox. They were principally on board with the concept of it, but again, had to find a publisher. So when it found a publisher, of which the executive editor, Eric Clofer, Eric Abrams Books, is a gigantic X-Files fan as well. So the listeners should know that one of the main editors on this project was all in from the start. And his enthusiasm for it actually was what, you know, he was the guy who said to me in person, send me that pitch. I want to see that. Like, don't pitch it elsewhere anymore. Just send me the pitch. So fandom top to bottom on a project like this. And so when the publisher has had effectively the agreement of Fox and they found the author, or there's an agreement made, what happens within that, of course, is that Fox reached out to Chris Carter and basically, you know, asked him about this kind of project and to get his blessing. And so he very kindly gave it his blessing, of course. And then the next time that a really special component of this book was while I was doing the gigantic rewatch, as you can imagine, and the words of notes was... the power of Blu-ray, thank goodness for high definition, gorgeous remasters of the X-Files, because hitting that pause button and doing the frame by frame, as a fan, I started to see details and things I hadn't seen before because the definition didn't allow it. So I'm seeing things like, which I know you guys will appreciate, you know, a name tag of somebody in a shop, which is just their first name, or it's a file that you see for 1.5 seconds, but there's some information on it. Cross camera.
Like a date. Or a time or something. Yeah. We're going to talk about dates, Paul. Don't worry.
I was obsessive about that stuff. And it was a case of even walking up to my TV and doing the, can I just see a little bit more of, is that an S? Is that an S or an M? So I'm that guy. But while I'm doing all that research, I started to realize that cross-checking against IMDb and the cast and crew lists, there were many of the minor characters who either didn't have a full name or just known by some arbitrary term. And I made this shopping list, essentially what it was. And through that process of writing and research, then sent that to my editors. There's always a process. So you send that to your publishing team. And I pitched this concept and I said, you know, I don't know whether Chris Carter would want to do this, but this feels like a really exciting opportunity that if he wanted to flesh out some of these minor characters and reveal their full names for the first time, and also maybe some more major reveals of character names, which did occur, and maybe some key dates that fans have been wondering for a while, that kind of stuff, would he like to do that? It's his show. It's his call entirely. And I was absolutely delighted to find out that he said, yes, I would like to add some of those things in. And then it got sort of, you know, amplified several notches when I heard via his office, via some emails, that, well, maybe Vince Gilligan and Frank Spotnitz would like to play as well. Maybe they'd like to. So, I mean, the list, the wish list that I had was pretty long, and it was, you know, covering, as you say, all those things I described. And it was really down to their choices, because sometimes, of course, this is the X-Files. It's fun to leave some things to mystery. Mm-hmm. It's fun to have things that are redacted and some things they would want to leave. But the characters, the way I always pitched it was, the characters that you would like to have a full name or revealed, that's your call. That whatever you want to give me, I will seed those Easter eggs throughout this book, and I will love, you know, the gradual response of fans playing investigator and going through the book and going, wait, that name doesn't sound familiar. Paul Terry just make up that name? No.
Okay, because that was going to be my next question, because I have a couple examples that I've written down. For example, the Great Mutato has a name, which is apparently Toby Lindala. So this was Chris Carter's. Obviously, this was the name that he 100%. Had for. Yeah. Okay. I was curious about that, if you had made that up. And my other question was Agent Pendrell, who has never had an officially canonized first name. I mean, we can see what we can see on the fan wiki. And I feel like his name has come up on like some trading cards, maybe. But no one really knows what his real name is. So it is Sean, is Agent Pendrell's first name.
It is Sean. And okay. I had a vague recollection, just as a fan, that maybe there was an old video game pre the PlayStation games. I think it maybe was one of the PC Mac games, you know, the big sort of adventure game in the big box. I had a vague recollection that there was a Sean Pendrell shown on the screen or mentioned, but I never, again, like yourselves, you think I don't remember it being
like I must have made
canon
that
specific. Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah. I must have made that up.
So did that I was just really dream that? Fun.
So I was really delighted to have things like that revealed. And interestingly, a couple of times I've heard this, which, you know, is a completely acceptable theory, is that, you know, we hear a character called Danny mentioned a lot. Danny's going to get this. We're going to call Danny about this. And I think a lot of people wonder whether it was Danny Pendrell, whether that was the kind of association.
You know, it's two people, right?
It is two people. Yeah. And that was another character that I was really delighted to see that Chris wanted to have the surname officially stated. So we have, as you've seen in the book, there's some really funny and well-placed Danny moments in the book. Some of them are paper prop moments, which are classic moments from the show, and some are just the way he's utilized in the case files as a way he's being referred to. So
I love the way you kind of are able, I mean, without really using Mulder and Scully, like the entire thing is sort of an homage to them. I love the idea that you utilize these secondary characters, or maybe even tertiary characters, as sort of our guides through this book. Like, we are familiar with them, but we don't know them very well, but we sort of get to know them in this book. And I think that was such a cool, unique opportunity. Was that your idea to do that?
Thank you so much. That's such a lovely assessment of it, because honestly, that was a huge part of the pitch and the concept, yes, which I wanted to do. The true north for me for this book was never break that in-world rule, keep it completely in-universe, and as you say, make sure that all these minor characters and tertiary characters are important to the case files and to the legacy of the show. So when it's appropriate, have them kind of come more into the light, if you like, and have them contribute in some way. Like Chuck, you know, with his with his tech awareness.
Oh, anything we love like, Chuck.
Any stuff like that feels like it's the right place for it. I really wanted them to have a chance to sing, even if it's a minor moment in an addendum. As you say, fans that love details, and the show is so rich and such a tangible bountiful world of details and characters and storylines that how could you not? But yeah, I was adamant to do that. And then of course, having Chris Carter, Frank Spotnitz and Vince Gilligan all contribute new things was just elevated the whole thing all over again. So amazing.
It's awesome that like they, I mean, I'm not surprised. We've talked to Frank too, by the way, and he's amazing. But I'm not surprised that they all wanted to be part of this because it does seem like they really still have a deep love for the show and would want to be involved in something like this. So, I mean, that's amazing that you got them. Can you share maybe like a detail or a special added information that Frank and Vince added?
Oh, you know, I'd have to,
You'd have to consult your notes.
I'd have to pull up the old Word documents, honestly, because there were so many notes. There were so many things. I'd have to kind of track my brain back through the episodes of... I think there were some really fun character reveal or additions in things like the Robbie, the human shark episode. Mm. There were some good details added there. You've caught me on the fly.
That's okay.
I know this stuff off the top of my head, but it's hundreds of thousands of words. This book, so it's like
you wait. Yeah. When you say human shark, you mean the Lucky Boy kid?
Yes.
I was like, I've never heard anyone refer to him as a human shark, but that's actually a really, really valid description. Well, yeah, I have not read this cover to cover yet because it's just so dense. But like, I did notice in that bit that it was like some of his fellow employees, like their thoughts about him when all this went down and just things like that. That was a Vince episode, right? That was a Vince Gilligan, I think.
Yes, I believe it was.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. I mean, that's amazing that you got them all to come to play. Like that must have been really fun to talk to them and get their input. That's awesome.
Well, they you know, they're very busy guys, but they supplied this stuff through email, which was it was more than I needed. You know, in those moments, you go, if you're going to take your time out of your crazy schedule to dig back into your minds and pull up, you know, remind yourself of the scripts or the characters and fill in these blanks. That was enough for me. That was incredible. But it's I love that you referenced the extra pieces at the end of that episode, because what I really loved about this book gave an opportunity to do things like that. So when you have a case that, you know, it's kind of a tragic case. You know, Rob's story is really tragic as what he was going through, and having almost like sympathy for the devil moments where you would have people contribute testimony, or even when I was watching an episode and make a note that it was definitively not really a closed case. I think they were the really exciting things to go, well, maybe we can kind of just hint at things that maybe Layla Harrison did what we did as fans or as viewers and went, huh, I wonder whether there's been any more rumblings about any more peacock rumblings or any more fluke man rumblings on the radar. So that was really fun to do.
Yeah. That's awesome. I wanted to point out too a detail that I noticed about the book that only a fan would do, and I have to give you huge kudos for this, is that all of the files before the season 5 finale are like burnt and restored because of the office fire. And when they aren't, you will very carefully, or you'll make a point to explain why. Like you'll be like, the original file was burnt, but these are Skinner's notes, or these are Skinner's he took a photocopy of it. And it's just like, honestly, I applaud your attention to detail. It is marvelous and worthy of any fan. So well done on that.
Thank you, because I knew going into this that if anyone wanted to publish this book, I already had that in the back of my mind going, pun intended, the fans are going to burn me if I get that wrong. If I just go, here are all the case files. Those are the classic episodes from the first 5 seasons. Oh, darn it. I've done it.
Oh, we would have.
So what was really fun about that, as you say, was, you know, some of them actually, I've not really talked about this actually in any interview, so I'm glad you brought this up. What I love about any sort of visual medium of anything creative, you can actually add a lot of subtext to a moment. So it's completely intentional that things like the Peacock's case and my German pronunciation just kicked in then. Unruhe.
Oh, yes.
I was like, don't get that wrong. The unrest episode. Mm-hmm. Because they're such dark cases, they have a higher degree of damage or restoration, because I wanted to get that flavor across that these were really dark episodes. But yes, of course, what I didn't want to do was have the fans by the sort of fourth or fifth moment I'd hit this theme go, oh, boy. Here we go. Harrison's explaining that it's another photocopy from another office. So I really wanted to make sure that there was an emotional grounding into what the case file actually was. So if it was something like a personal case to Scully, that she explained that, you know what, I kept this a personal copy of these case file notes because I needed to process this, or likewise for Mulder, or if it was from a kind of CDC type organization that had a copy because of what went down, they right. supplied their master copy. So for me, it was incredibly important to be as creative as possible and also not as ridiculous as possible, really ground it in the world of the X-Files as to where these files came from, so that Harrison could deal with it before the evil sort of subterfuge of the digitizing process was underway.
Yeah. I always find it funny in that episode where Mulder is like attempting to sort of like put them all back together. And I'm like, oh, okay, we're doing this. But we can assume that he did that with several. So,
yeah, I love that. It's the moisture restoration.
I love that.
I think I threw that in there, one of the case files. Like, Mulder did a pretty good job of this moisture restoration.
Yeah. He really did. Yeah. I love it. Like, if it comes from like another agency or something, it'll have like the stamp of that other agency
like
on
their there, letterhead
like,
and stuff.
Like their letterhead or the police department that it's from. So I just love, I mean, it all looks so, just even like as a person who's worked in offices for like 20 years, it looks so authentic in terms of just the stationery and the files and the paper, and it looks like it's 20 years old too. It doesn't look like it's from you know, last week. It looks like paper that's aged. So it's just, I love all that. It just looks so real.
Well, just to jump on that, because that's a really, I love that you said that. The I must give a huge shout out, of course, to Headcase Design, who designed this book, Paul Keppel and Alex Bruce, because from the get-go, they were completely on board with the level of crazy detail that I know I wanted in the book and the publishers wanted in the book. But it's having a wish list or a dream list of things you'd like to achieve in any in-world publication, it's kind of where you start. And then it's a case of, well, you know, how obsessive are we going to get with things? And the first conversations that we were having about things like, I'm a huge font nerd. I could talk to you about fonts for hours, which is so exciting for people who can't be bothered with fonts. But these were the right designers, because I said, okay, now these case files span, you know, from the 90s through to, you know, season 10, 11. So we need to research and look at what fonts were being used by government agencies and files at those times.
Oh my
God. So we need the reader to, and it's a subtle thing that I think, even if you aren't aware that that was a plan, right. I think if you leaf through the book, I would even say on a subconscious level, you get a sense of the passage of time, because things like, you know, sans serif fonts or you know, more use of courier on certain things, they come and go in the sort of in the evolution of, I guess, you know, the, our how we as humans like to impart information. But to me, it was incredibly important to land the authenticity of a book like this. And it also speaks to the moments where you have, if there's a case file where there's been an update of that case file, if it's some years later, where due to damage or if it's the final word on a case, we all kind of stopped and checked ourselves, and I'd say my Word documents to the guys, okay, reminder, although the episode's aired at this point, this is the year that I want the case file to be set because of these reasons. So for me, it was very important that I helped as much as possible with that stuff. So when I was doing my grand rewatch, I also made a ton of sort of almost like art direction notes, because I wouldn't expect any designer to sit through 200 episodes of a show to design a book. But it would be things like that. It would say, you know, okay, this needs to be on this kind of printer paper for the transcription of this interrogation of Toombs, and it's in this year, so it should be on this kind of printer. What printers existed in offices at that time?
Wow.
How would the paper look? Would it have the tears at the sides? Mm-hmm. So, if fans are wondering the obsessive level of detail that was put into this book, I promise you, not a stone was left unturned. We wanted to make sure this was as authentic as we could get it.
It definitely, great. I love it. It really shows, too. Yeah. Like you say, whether you're conscious of it or not, whether you know about these things, just looking at it, it just looks right, and it just is just, and it just so beautifully printed too. It just jumps off the page.
Yeah, they did Abrams did an amazing job of considering how to do that. I love the fact that the stock inside is a very thick paper stock, but then I love the fact that it has this kind of super thick card book, sort of board book style, they call it, with the way the pages are flushed to the edge. It really feels like
it's like die cut.
Yeah. And it's a style you don't see that often, but again, it's so true to someone said some weeks back that this really feels like a prop from the show, and I almost fell off my chair. I was like, you've made my day.
Yeah,
the intention is that, you know, apart from the barcode, this should feel like, you know, it is actually a piece, an archived volume of cases that Harrison has literally put the seal on and gone, okay, that's that dealt with, job done.
Yeah,
it really does feel like that.
It really brings kind of a nice sense of closure to a lot of these. Like, that's kind of what I like. I mean, as much as these, like you say, can be closed. How did these cases get decided? Like, did you pick which ones you wanted to do, or did they tell you which ones to do, or were there any that like didn't quite make the cut that you would have wanted to do?
Well, as part of the pitch, it was, although there was the sort of elevator pitch I described earlier, you have to have a bit more sort of a substantial pitch to something like this. So it was always a kind of monster of the week, classic monster of the week, as the larger part of the pitch, with some kind of examples about the things that should be in this first book. But the really cool thing was, I knew I was going to do a full rewatch because I wanted to see how the emotionality of the characters' story arcs kind of, where is it at when we hit certain monster of the week episodes? You know, where is this at with Mulder and Scully's relationship? How is the syndicate behaving at this particular time in the shadows in the background? Because I wanted to infuse a lot of that little bits of seasoning in the kind of anecdotes from Harrison and stuff like that. But whilst doing that rewatch, I just started to make tons of notes about categorizing each of these episodes. And what I realized was that within the Monsters of the Week episodes, there are so many categories, of course. You know, there's the occult, there's cryptids, there's, you know, parapsychic phenomena. And then when I had all those color-coded and bunched together, it just felt like, oh, okay, this first book really should be about terrestrial anomalies. That's really how I sort of termed it. And, well, you know, aliens, UFOs, and the Syndicate was so gigantic as a concept. I said this to the publisher. I said, even if we did a couple or even 20% of the classic, more considered standalone type alien moments on the show, it won't work. Because it will jar with the theme of the cryptids and all that kind of stuff that's being investigated in this volume. It just wasn't the right time to handle something as vast and as complicated as all the alien stuff is so interconnected with the Syndicate thing. So, and I just felt like classic Monster of the Week things is the right entry point for this kind of book.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, I was going to save this question for the end, but does that mean there might be more coming? Because I would die if you did one of these that was just all mythology. Like, I think that would be epic.
I will say that that if the question is, have I planned this to be more than one book as a concept? The answer is yes.
Okay.
Because as you'll see when you go through the book get through it and get to the end, that there are several things that sort of go beyond the cryptids, biological anomalies, and the parapsychic phenomena. And there are references to things like the Syndicate. Mm-hmm. And there maybe is a letter from Agent Harrison as she closes the volume, which discusses where she's at with the mission. Unfortunately, with all these such things, all official licensed books, it all comes down to how well is it going to do?
Yeah.
You know, how are fans going to receive it? How well is it going to sell before anyone can commit to future copies, to future volumes, sorry. But yes, if fans are wondering if it has been planned or conceived to be more than one book, 100%. And
good.
And to quote the dear show, maybe there's hope.
Yes, we love that idea. So really, everyone listening needs to run out right now, buy a copy of the book. The more copies that we buy, the more likelihood we'll see more of it.
Just to say, it's lovely to speak to you guys today. And I just want to say a shout out to every single person who has supported this book in some way, be it, you know, you guys doing the podcast shows, the interviews, the reviews, any shares, the retweets, whatever it is, buying the book, of course, because I've been overwhelmed by the fan response. You know, it broke the sold out situation. A lot of online retailers and people are going, why is I can't get it? And it's like, yeah, they're trying to get more batches. So
there's a lot of international fans that want to get it and are having trouble from what I've seen. So
yeah, and that's blown me away. I mean, I would never have pitched an idea that I thought the fans wouldn't want, because that's kind of, you know, you've got to stand by your ideas firmly. But The fan response has been extraordinary. So I genuinely, from the bottom of my heart, thank you to everybody who supported this book. It means a ton.
Oh, that's amazing.
Thank you. I think that there's such a hunger for good sort of authentic X-Files content, which of course we don't really get anymore. And so to get something that's really, you know, canon content at this stage is like a miracle to us fans. So I can see why people would want to get their hands on it. And you really should get your hands on it. Like I say, the actual hard copy is amazing to have, and just knowing all the thought and detail that went into it just makes it so worthwhile, and really worthwhile supporting as a project, because I love it when people make something like this out of passion for the material, because it shows. Yeah. And it's something that should be lauded and encouraged, I think.
Thank you so much. That's lovely.
I hope that you, I mean, we have a lot more to talk about, so I'm gonna save that for later. But I wanted to go back to something you said like a few minutes ago. You were talking about that maybe perhaps Mulder and Scully might have kept some of these files for personal reasons. And one that stood out to me in particular was your notes from Scully on the Faster case. I really, really liked seeing that, because I feel like a lot of the time, just because of the nature of the show and the way it was made, we didn't really get a lot of sort of their reactions to things and like the actual impact that these cases would have had on them as people. And that is really, I think, important for fans, especially, I think, regarding Scully and especially some of those particularly nastier cases. So I really, really enjoyed that. And so I wanted to thank you for putting that in, because it's just really nice to see Scully in particular grappling, I should say, with that, the aftermath of that case. I really liked that. So thank you for including that.
Well, thank you for calling that out, because that was one of my favorite pieces to write, to work on, because, mm-hmm. you know, those cases, those episodes have always terrified me, and they're very distressing, especially for Scully, when you're watching those episodes. And it was really important to me that, although when, of course, a field report is written and submitted as a case file, there's going to be a sort of drier component to the language and linguistics of how it's reported. But as you say, it was really important to me for the emotionality of those moments to capture it in some way. And it could be a very subtle thing. With the Donnie Faster case, it was so traumatizing. And I think what the really inspiration from it, of course, is the show itself and the episodes and the writers of the show being so amazing, is that the way that you had the voiceover in those episodes, especially in the first one, you have Scully processing and you see the trauma that she's experiencing. You just can't ignore that if you're going to do an in-world book that confronts such a terrifying case to her personally. That was one I spent a lot of time in all of them, but that was one that I really kind of, you know, cranked the gears down a little bit and just kind of went, okay, let's just be quiet and be peaceful. And I really wanted to try and do my best at capturing her voice and just where her headspace would be at in terms of addressing this is the final word on Donnie Faster. And just capturing the spirit of that. So I'm glad that you felt that, you know, I did an okay job of that. Thank you.
Yeah.
No, I loved that. I love that bit too. I love the fact that there's this combination of the really cool, like, wow, sort of paper props, as you call them. But the writing is really good too. And we get like little insights that, of course, you know, on TV, once the episode's over, it's over. And there's rarely a reference back to it. But here we do get like some little insights after sort of the events of the episode have ended. So there's a whole little sort of novel happening within the book as well, which is kind of cool to read too.
Thank you. And that's actually that was one of the most exciting things and terrifying things to do with a book like this, because, you know, not only you can't get in your head too much, because then you would just throw the keyboard out the window, wouldn't do it. But getting to write in these characters' voices is obviously, you know, a dream come true. But then to really try and drill into where their emotional state was at those points in those cases is a whole other level. And I really wanted to, there were other examples of it, like the Leonard Betts case, of course. You know, I stared at that and I told it that for a while. I was thinking, we have to, even in a subtext way, we have to kind of address the fact that this is the cancer moment. This is the moment that Scully finds out. And it went through a few different ideas. And then it's very subtle. And I think that it's important. It's very subtle. But if fans had the book and they read, I think it's on the last page as the report wraps up. And it's Scully addressing Leonard Betts' mother. And the way that she the language she uses about his mum, I wanted it to have an echo, almost like she's saying something to herself, that Scully is saying something to herself about how am I going to process this. But, you know, you can't say that. You can't put a hat on a hat and go, you know, oh, and Skinner, as you found out, I don't know how I'd process this, because it's a really delicate thing, and it's a very fragile thing for her character to have dealt with. But it had to be dealt with, in even in incredibly subtle ways. So I really hope that when fans read through this, they know that, of course, you know, there's no way I would have approached a book like this just doing episode recaps.
Right.
This is what happened on our jaunt towards, you know, the Big Blue situation or the Chupacabra. It was, for me, it was much more important to try my best to capture where they were at in terms of their relationship with the office, their relationship with what's going on, you know, in syndicate terms, if there's any little embellishments with that, with Kirsch, with Spender, or whatever's happening in that moment. I decided that, yeah, you have to, the fans are going to kill you if you don't address key things like when the X-Files was done with, you know, when it was kind of shut down, it wasn't the situation. So they were really fun and made it much more satisfying experience to really drill into that stuff.
Well, I have it open. Actually, I'm going to read this Leonard Betts bit that you're talking about. You have it saying, and this is Scully's report. Medical records showed that Mrs. Tanner's metastatic had returned. How she will cope with the fact that despite being given a clean bill of health 3 months prior to this incident, her body decided to regrow cancer is unknown. So that's what you're referring to, right? How she's sort of in her head saying that, like, how are people going to deal with this knowledge? But she's not really saying it, but she's saying it to us, the reader, who know what's going on. So that's actually really, really interesting.
Yeah, because when you're reading the notes in any parts of the book, as fans, we know so much. And so we as fans bring so much to the book. Like, if you're not a fan, you're probably, a lot of this is not quite, you'd still find it a fascinating thing to look at, but you're not quite getting all the little hints and points.
Right.
But as it's almost interactive in a sense that we're bringing our knowledge as fans to the book, and we are sort of mining little details from it based on our experience and our knowledge, which is a very cool experience when you're reading it.
That's really great to hear that, because again, that's something that you're giving me all my best pull quotes. Can I just have this all my best quotes?
Go for it.
No, it's lovely to hear that, because you're absolutely right. And one key thing when you're doing anything which is in world, of course, is that once you realize that you have to commit to those rules, you're 100% right. The fans sometimes know way more than the investigators.
Yeah.
So it was really crucial going through these cases every single time to track it on a document, going, okay, what did they see? What were they there? What didn't they see? Okay, well, they weren't aware of that. You know, the fans were aware of that cold open mystery reveal, but they never saw that. They never even met this person, whatever it was, some of the tertiary characters. But then what's exciting then is you have that kind of push to one side, and you can use it as a framing device in certain regards, or you can go, okay, let's figure out a way of giving the fans that memory of that experience. And a great example of that actually is the Faster case, and one of my happiest things to get in there was, I was always fascinated and really scared by those flashes of the demonic form of Donnie Faster, that it was so brilliantly done on the show, because it could still be open to interpretations to what really is happening there in the moment, and psychologically and emotionally. And we had these really amazing photographic references that they did in when I was going through all the Fox archives of the guy with the full prosthetic makeup. And I was staring at these pictures and going, well, they can't go in the case file as, you know, as photographic evidence, because again, this isn't something that was captured. But then I realized that, okay, there's this character in the cold open of the first Donnie Faster episode where he gets a glimpse of that. He gets a glimpse of that form in the funeral home. And then that's what inspired, there's a section in the case file where that minor character, he gets a moment. He gets a moment in the spotlight where years later I frame it that, you know, racked with guilt and nightmares, he makes a statement, and then he describes what he sees to a sketch artist. And that was the opportunity to say to the head case design guys, okay, this needs to be like a witness, like a sketch artist sketch, but here's the reference that's from the show, is the photographic reference. So we get to add in that sort of supernatural component to the faster cases, because I really felt that if we didn't address that at all, that's wrong. That's not the episodes. That's not the show.
So. Well, and that's just really clever to come up with a way, because, like, you know, I'm not sure in this particular case if this was necessarily the case, but, like, maybe Scully might not have reported that. Like, there are things that maybe Scully might withhold that information. And so you need to find this external witness who can bring that to the book. And that's just really super clever. Yeah.
And he gets to tell a whole little story. He turns into, like, a whole little fleshed out character, which is great.
Yeah. I hope there's some of the actors who play a lot of the minor characters who maybe find out about this book and go, oh, I wonder whether I get a mention. I probably won't get a mention. And they go, wait, I got a whole addendum.
Yeah.
And wait, that's my full name. That's really cool.
So, stuff I had no idea about myself. Yeah.
That would be cool.
That's really cool. I actually, kind of coming off what we were just talking about, I have a question from a listener from Izadub. Said, first, congrats to him for his amazing book. Second, how did he proceed to find the style of writing reports for Mulder and Scully? I guess we were just talking about how you're finding their voice, but you also kind of acknowledged the fact that they can be a little dry. You know, we have these sort of... I don't want to say monotone, but they're just very dry case reports at times. So you have to be able to find their voices. How did you manage to do that?
It came from the show, honestly. Mm-hmm. It came from listening very carefully to the rhythm of the characters' voices and their choice of words. You know, there's fans, I'm sure, as I'm saying this, are already hearing things like Scully says all the time, like, Mulder, are you suggesting, or, you know, Agent Mulder suggested that this is the, and there's,
yeah.
there's, and Mulder has a, Mulder chains a lot of words. If you listen carefully to a lot of his voiceover, where you're hearing him address something on a case that's kind of almost like, it could be a quasi draft of the case file, or just the way his thoughts are going, he chains a lot of words together. So he almost has a longer kind of flow to his thought processes. But it really came from, the amazing writing on the show of the characters, and then, you know, Jill and David's choices as what they brought the characters, and just drilling into that. And once you do drill into it, it's a really, an uncanny thing happens where it almost takes over your brain a bit. So when I was doing a case file, which was purely from Scully's perspective, and you're figuring out and you're going through my rewatch notes, I'm starting to write it, you just hear it. You hear the way that she talks, and then you delete stuff back and go, no, you'll redraft it and go, oh, no, Scully wouldn't say that. And, and there was even a few times, even in the process, which of course happens with all books, where you're having a conversation with the editorial team and they might suggest a change. And then I was that guy on the phone call or on the email going, well, respectfully, you know, Dana Scully would never say that.
Yeah, exactly. I love that.
You feel like you're protecting a friend. You're like,
yeah.
Friend Dana would not put it in that way. She's too smart for this. Or, you know, it's just so that it totally came from the show. And it's just listening very carefully, making notes, studying rhythms, because really that's what it comes down to when you're capturing those sentence structures in that way. But then, as you say, it is a really fine balance, because this is a field report being handed to Skinner and going on file. So you have to figure out a way of capturing the character's voice that's familiar. And then at the right points, I would say, have the slight few degrees left and right leanings into things they might want to address that are more personal to them. But again, it's so great the show did that, right? You know, when you're watching episodes, and especially in the early parts of the show, there was a lot of Scully voiceover and a lot of Scully working on a draft of rapport. So we get to see and hear the kind of sort of colors that she brings her field reports, which did have some really nice little flares of things about morality, or, you know, about serial killers and things like that. And same with Mulder, but they're very different. Mm-hmm. And so actually some of the challenges were figuring out, as you see in the book, you know, and I think correctly and appropriately. So some cases are Agent Mulder leading the report and filing the case. Some are just Dana Scully, but then some are combined. They are, it's a joint report from both of them with shared thoughts. And so obviously you might detect where I'm going with this, but some of the really fun things to do with things like bad blood.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
It's two completely unreliable narrations. And as a viewer, you're going, what? How did it really go down? And then figuring out that, okay, well, it has to be a joint report because that's the gag of the episode. Mm-hmm. But then figuring out the vernacular in the episode and doing little Easter eggs and how they had that conflict with each other and how they resolved it.
And what did they settle on? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. What did they settle on? Who agreed with what, you know, and oftentimes for me, the enjoyment of that as well was in all the cases was figuring out, what to leave out, and also what to state from the agent's perspective. But maybe as a viewer and a fan, it might catch you off guard and go, that's not what happened. But then I want to think, what would have Mulder said on the record? And things like the vampire episode in the Not Bad Blood, the three.
Right.
What would Mulder have said on the record? Yeah. And it's not precisely what we see go down.
Exactly. Yeah. He leaves some things out.
and I think that's exactly what should happen. Or when he's defending something that Scully did, that maybe as viewers we go, well, that's not quite how that mm-hmm. gunplay went down at the end. But he's going to go on the record and mm-hmm. defend his partner, saying she had no choice. That's what happened. End of. I stand by that. So
that's again, interesting. That's what like, I mean, I think you're probably alluding to Orison, where like you hear in the episode when he says, my report will reflect that. But then we never get to see that report. But now we do.
And now
so,
do.
Yeah.
That's, and his report really does reflect that.
Yeah. As we knew it would. But it's, I love that, though. I mean, again, just the attention to detail is awesome. So you keep referring to this insane rewatch that you did, and we can both relate, as we're constantly either just finishing, just beginning, or in the middle of one.
It's an eternal one.
Yeah, but your obsessive note taking, I have to ask, as an obsessive note taker myself, a lover of spreadsheets and timelines and things like that, how did you deal with contradictory information? I would say specifically dates. Contradicting perhaps with reality or with how certain things could have possibly taken place. Did you run into that? Because I run into that all the time.
Yeah, give me some examples, actually, because it might be from episodes that weren't featured in the book or more related to mythology or things, or when episodes maybe were in a different broadcast audio, or they switched things around so things didn't quite line up in those respects. But
this isn't me calling you out, because I think had like an impossible task, because I feel like there are there are some dates that deliberately contradict like where it takes place in the airing order. Or so in my mind, I go, OK, well, this, for example, Milagro, it airs at the end of and you don't have Milagro in this book, but I'm just saying it airs at the end of season 6. So you would think, OK, probably like, you know, May 99 or something like that. But there's a newspaper in it that says February. And so you're like, oh, OK, so it actually must have taken place earlier in that season, like before this episode, et cetera. One that jumped out at me in particular in your book that was the case for plus one, for the last case in the book. Uh-huh. It said the date was August 23rd of 2018. But I was wondering where you got that date from, because like that doesn't seem possible to me, because the finale of season 11 took place in March. And so I was like, okay, wait, so does this actually take place later? Or is there maybe, I always chalk it up to like typos. I'm like, oh, there was a typo on the report. I'm sure it happens when I see this happening on the show. But I'm very curious where you got that specific date, for example, because I don't know where that one came from in terms of the timeline.
It's interesting, because a better example of things like, so for me, doing the rewatch, things like the ice episode, and then, and how the distance of time between that and the cases that follow, or when they return to LA for cases. So you're right. You're correct in many respects, because
or after Scully came back from her abduction, there are some ridiculous dates that happen right after that.
And you know, it's what's fascinating really in a more of a macro comment is that TV as we know it now, things like mythology heavy shows, which have internet discussions upon the millions about every little detail, I think that showrunners and writers' rooms have to be, if they choose to be, so unbelievably drilled into this stuff. But I think back in the 90s doing a show about unexplained phenomena, and again, we're not seeing all that detail on the reports and things, or just, you know, hey, we're just telling stories.
Yeah.
They're not going to necessarily track things to the letter. What I would say to the fans is, what was really fascinating was a lot of the clues and the guides as to what was committed to with dates are actually on the props. So that gives you a really different perspective on how things actually all line up. For example, in the Guy Mann episode, and the date line of, if you look at all the reports, the actual dates on that, I won't give it away, because I want fans to sort of investigate this themselves. But you will see things that then go, oh, okay, okay, that's interesting, because it's there in the reports. Mm-hmm. So for me, that was probably one of the biggest points of discovery, as you say, doing the rewatch, doing all these notes, trying to figure out how is the timeline of existence of the X-Files? How does it all align? Yeah. And then when you start to see the paper props and the items from the show and the reports, and then double checking on, was that shown on camera? Was that shown? What was that newspaper incident, whatever it was? And then corroborating that it was and going, oh, okay. And then, yeah, there was a little bit of, you know, shall I say, sort of like yoga maneuvers going on in my mind and my body going, well, I have to resolve this because we're trying to figure this out in the book. But by and large, with the cases that we dealt with in this one, it wasn't as much as a, oh, no, moment as I thought it might be, to be honest, with a lot of those things. Just because it wasn't a priority. They were just telling stories about situations. But as you say, doing a detailed book like this, fans demand it, right? You know, they want to go through all the juicy dates. But there was one specific date, which I don't know whether you were segueing to, but one specific date did come from Chris Carter, it's probably... in an unbelievably nerdy statement, of all the dates that were revealed in the official archives, this is the one that matters the most, is the arson attack on The Office.
Oh, yeah, and, yeah. I saw that. I definitely saw that.
Book, and that came from Chris Carter, because that wasn't known until this book. So thank goodness he revealed that, because that does track beautifully with season 5 into the movie. So that's right.
Yeah, and another thing I noticed, this is just me, I'm not ragging on you, I'm ragging on the show, because it's just, and it's, again, it's not me saying you guys did not do your diligence, because it's a television show. At the end of the day, like you said, they're not really obsessively tracking this stuff. Stuff happens, things change, but what I've run into a lot when I'm trying to kind of like put my timeline together is, by the nature of it being a television show, you're going to often have the cliffhanger of one season and the premiere of the next season like literally right next to each other, and yet there's 3 months that just disappear, and so there's a lot of maneuvering when you're kind of trying to be like, okay, well, the Office fire was in May, I believe, right? I don't know the exact date, but you got the date correct.
So the Office fire is in August.
Oh, it was in August, sorry.
So I would say that the that is interesting. It's a great point you make, because oftentimes the broadcast time of the year or the month or whatever it was, that seemed to be a very recurring thing, that it didn't completely echo the actual narrative placement of the story. And it happened a bunch of times, actually. There was, for fans who, when they check out the Millennium case file, the Frank Black case file, which is in this book, I mean, there's a date which is undeniable.
Yeah.
and then you're looking at case files in and around that episode, and then looking at the props and going through the archives, and then having things corroborated, going, oh, of course that takes place before that.
Rush actually happens before Millennium, not correct. After, for example. Yes,
exactly. And to me, that's it's a really progressive thing the show did, I think, in terms of, you know, in some respects, yes, of course, there are shuffles of things. But in terms of committing to those kind of ideas, we see TV shows now all the time tell a story that's like, oh, this isn't in the continuum of the storyline. It's jumped back a couple of months or whatever it is. And I found that really fun, going, that is actually something that I didn't completely, you know, commit to in my brain when I was doing several other fan watches. But doing a rewatch like this, honestly, it's a very different experience. I couldn't really sit there with popcorn and enjoy it. It was constantly
it was work.
It was work. Yeah.
Speaking of Millennium, I have to give you a shout out for doing what the show didn't do and giving Scully's tattoo a shout out in the book, because you actually include a picture of her tattoo in the Millennium case, which I gotta tell you, I enjoyed greatly. So thank you.
Thank you for spotting that. And again, that was something where you go, we have to address the Ouroboros of it. Come on.
Right?
And how do we do it in a really subtle way? And there were a few ideas that, again, not throwing anybody under the bus, there were some ideas that came across my way that we're not doing that. There was a hat on a hat on a hat of, you know, we're not addressing the tattoo. Come on. We've got to be cleverer than that. And the fact that symbol is such a, you know, a mystical and powerful symbol in itself anyway. And obviously it's to do with the Millennium Group. But Yeah, I'm glad that you love the subtle shout out of the mm-hmm. symbol. But also, I'll just dig into this one little Easter egg thing, because we were trying to figure out a way of getting Never Again in the phrase in that case file. And Layla Harrison does use that. She does use that phrase.
She does.
I won't spoil it, but there's a little aside that she talks about. I think it's she was offered an experience of like a field experience or a training exercise thing, and she uses
Never
that
again.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
yeah, I read that and I was like, oh, I see what you did there.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah,
so great.
That's the stuff that is really entertaining. You know, it's entertaining for me to do, because, and then you think, that's subtle enough, you know.
Yeah.
And actually, I'm really happy with how the Millennium case ends, because, again, there were some conversations about, well, you know, we have to address that, the big romantic moment at the end. And I go, no, we don't. It's a case report. But we can do it again. We can do a very subtle thing. So as fans will see when they read the case report, I think it's literally the last line of the report.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of has a couple of different qualities to it. It comes across a little bit kind of amusing and pithy to what they just experienced, but also it's almost like an in-joke to Mulder and Scully, because yeah. they were the only two people there when that line was said.
Yep.
That's right.
So
yeah, it's very sweet. I love that part. Yeah.
I was wondering about that, because I mean, I don't know how much you know about Jen and I in our podcast, but we are obviously huge shippers, so we comb the book for any.
I'm here too.
Good.
I'm a big romantic sap, and so the romance of Mulder and Scully throughout the entire show. And I said this many times before, but for me, I call them the almost moments. For me, the most wonderful, most powerful things the show does throughout this entire run, it's the. Oh, they're almost touching fingers while they're recovering from something.
Mm-hmm.
It's the half look. It's Mulder after Triangle going, telling her, I love you. And her going, he's so whacked out on all drugs right now.
He doesn't mean it. Yeah.
And just walking out the scene and like the, you know, what did she say? Like, no, brother. And just walks off. And there's a fan, you're screaming. You're going, he's just done it. He's just told it. And I believe... My fan self believes Mulder was actually trying to get that across to her in that moment, but it's even though he was, you know, on a lot of medication, but I think he meant it. Yeah.
Let me tell you, Paul, you just went up a ton of points on this podcast. So.
Yeah, wow.
But
we
I do
liked you a lot, but now you're right in there. And I have to say, reading through the book, I read everything through kind of a shipper lens, and I'm like, this feels a little shippy to me. I mean, it's very subtle, like you say. If you're not a shipper, you probably wouldn't really pick up on it. But I thought, if I didn't know anything about the X-Files or these characters and I was reading these case reports, I'd think, I think there might be a little something going on between Mulder and Scully here.
And I would say this, honestly. I think that my, you know, shipping, however you want to term it, but my appreciation of the show and my investment in the show as it went forward, of course, was the center point of the whole experience of the cases is Mulder and Scully. And so I, as a fan from the start, as a teenager, was getting a sense of their rapport and their little moments, like, you know, the you know, the snack in the bag about, you know.
Oh, yeah, the iced tea in the bag.
The iced tea, yeah. It's they're such lovely little moments. But to me, that is where the power of any relationship that's being developed on a TV show exists. It's all those tiny moments.
Yeah.
And so... I honestly think that when doing a book like this, all I'm doing is honoring all of that stuff.
Yeah.
I don't think that I'm bringing anything. I don't think I'm amplifying anything that isn't there. I'm just capturing and reflecting the truth of the show, which is they've always loved and cared about each other. And it's just been a long journey and a very complicated one.
And no show did it better.
It would come through a little bit in their case reports, probably, you know, the sort of admiration they have for each other. You couldn't help but have it show up in case reports if you're writing them. So it makes total sense to me.
I mean the there's so many that spring to mind, but I love the it's such a trippy and brave and bonkers episode, but the field trip episode.
Oh yes.
When they're reflecting upon, you know, what they went through, and even within the hallucination experiences, you know, I really got that sense as a fan that you know, Scully's really, really wrestling with it, with what she's going through. And Mulder's almost just been taken by the wish fulfillment aspect of it. But it's, I really think through Gillian's performance and the writing and the way the show puts across the storyline is that she's really she's addressing a lot of things, which again, yeah, as fans were going, oh my God, like, and then to have that moment between them at the end with the touching of the fingers just is like, is perfection. But yeah, there's so many moments that, and I do address that in the case file. There's a very subtle way I wanted to have them address what they almost lost, I think is the best way of describing it. But the three episode for me was really crucial to drill into what was happening there, because Scully's missing. She's still gone. Mulder's desperately trying to find her. And so where his headspace is at writing that case file and even dealing with that case, was essential. You can't not address that, otherwise you're totally failing writing an X-Files book.
I remember reading that one and thinking that, like, I'm like, well, there were things that we thankfully didn't need to read about or wouldn't be reading about, but there's also some stuff that it's nice to see that he is admitting that he's in this dark place and he, you know, doesn't really know what's going on or how he's doing or how he's even muddling through. And it's nice to hear that even in like his case report, because I feel like Mulder, I feel like that's very accurate and very in character for him to actually address that in the field report. It's very Mulder. It's funny though that you bring up the field trip one, because I like a couple hours before this interview, I just sent that to one of my X-Files like group chats, that the part, and I was just like, y'all, am I crazy or is this shippy? Like, and I sent it to them because I love the final sentence is Scully saying, whatever the fungal organism is, it powerfully taps into not only personal fears, but also key qualities by which a person defines themselves. In this case, my ability as a medical doctor and my role as Agent Mulder's partner. It's almost like she doesn't even realize what she's saying. Like, she doesn't realize the power of what she's saying, but it's completely, utterly believably Scully. So,
I love the fact you got that from it, because I'm not just saying it because you said it, but it's but that that is the kind of thing that when you're writing a project like this, that's exactly those moments you want to try and capture.
Yeah,
is the levels to it, that it's not one thing or the other, or even are you capturing a character wrestling with something in their subconscious that they're not even aware of? Because again, I give all the props in the world to the show, because that's what the show did in those moments. It really gives you just a really delightful sort of feeling as a fan that you're invested in these characters, but you're seeing things on such a, you know, dare I say it, you know, not intelligent, but very complicated, nuance, or just real, you know, relationships are very complicated and nuanced and a wonderful array of colors. And that's what I think the show always did really, really well, was it never went for the easy shots.
Never.
And I think that you said that a second ago, and it's not because it is my favorite show of all time. It's just the fact that I can't think of another show. And I love a lot of TV shows. A lot of TV shows and films are incredibly well written and do amazing things with character development and relationships. But I truly believe that even now there are a bunch of writers' rooms who are trying to figure out, you know, a dynamic between a duo. And I can't believe that Mulder and Scully doesn't come up in conversation, because as the standard, you know, it took, you know, yeah, like 8-9 years to even get anywhere near the feeling that we were kind of sensing about the characters within themselves on camera. So it's it's an extraordinary long game. Well played, Chris Carter. You kept us guessing, and you kept us hoping for a long time.
Yeah, sure. I mean, and both Jen and I are appreciative, and we really love the slow burn. I think that and they did it so well. And like I said, it was just like little morsels here and there, and a lot of it you didn't see by design. And I think that was a really great way to sort of give people what they want without sort of messing with the integrity of the show. And I think that was really important, and I think very well done. And that meant that every little bit that we got was just priceless. It was, and it was really amazing the way that we got to see it slowly develop. And even later, even years and years later, you're still wondering what was going on and when was it going on and all of that stuff. Everybody's always wondering still. And I mean, that's the power of such a great show.
So, I mean, a little fight the future memory, in the cinema memory. So I went to see that in the theaters, of course, and I took my buddy Nick, who he loved all this stuff, but he'd never watched the X-Files by this point. It wasn't the show that he was on. He was more of a film guy, and and he said, oh, but I love science fiction, I love all this stuff, so I'll come and see it with you, and this will be the perfect test. Will the X-Files movie make sense to me and will I enjoy it as a piece, or did I need previous, you know, five seasons of information? And he loved it to pieces.
Yeah.
What was really great was in this moment being next to him and the near kiss moment before the bee sting and just the way they perform that scene, and it's just electrifying anyway, even before they get close to one another. But I can still remember, I've got that sense memory, the whole theatre just pressing their backs against the chairs. You can just feel the gasp, like they are not going to do it.
Yeah.
Are they going to do it? And then at the side of my eye, Nick's doing it. Nick's like, I'm not this guy, you had a kiss. And he's got no investment. He's got no prior investment in the show.
Yeah.
And that's when I knew a couple of things. I knew that the power of the world, I love this phrase when you say, you know, actors come to the screen with a character and it's fully formed,
mm-hmm.
you know, within seconds or minutes, if it's a new TV show. And I felt like that's a great description of the pilot. I think that show just appeared into the world fully formed.
Yeah.
We just went, yeah, this is it. Scully has been given this assignment. Here she goes. And then that's it, in. But mm-hmm. to see a dear friend of mine be that invested in that moment when he'd had what? 60 minutes of time investment in it with brand new characters that he knew nothing about,
yeah,
was proof, I think.
I love it.
I love Fight the Future stories, honestly. Like, people will always get upset about that near kiss moment, but I mean, Jen and I always argue that they couldn't have done it any other way. Like, we still talk about that moment and that intense reaction people have to seeing that because they didn't kiss. If they had kissed, nobody would be talking about that. But it's that moment of the, let's pull it back. We're going to do this. We're going to acknowledge it. We're putting it out there. You guys were right all along, but we're pulling it away and making you wait two more years at least.
Totally. Totally. And also the characters in that sequence, in that scene, the tensions have been building. And they're emotionally so fraught and distressed, and it's all that stuff that's bubbling under the surface, as well as their love for each other. And I think it's just, it's an exquisitely written moment and performed moment. And I wouldn't change a thing about that moment, or indeed the movie. I've got a big love for Fight the Future, just as a piece of science fiction.
Yeah.
I think that it was really cleverly written and directed to, as it proved with my friend, to actually be a piece of science fiction from the prologue with the prehistoric stuff right through to the ending and how it all wraps up, that is a piece. You are introduced to Mulder and Scully in the midst of a very tense, a bomb threat situation. You immediately get their dynamic from the roof and the interplay and the dialogue and the hierarchy of everything that works within that unit. And it's not given enough praise, I think, for those kind of qualities as a piece of science fiction.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think it does stand alone really well. I mean, I think it actually gets unfair criticism for being too complicated. And I often watch it and I go, really? Who can't follow this enough to at least get the gist of what you're watching?
Yeah.
Like, you're not going to pick up on all the little in things for all of the people that have been watching the show from the beginning. But you can kind of guess. You can see what's going on. You can
totally
follow it. Yeah. And I think that it did a really good job with, I think, a really daunting task. So, yeah, Fight the Future really, really... Mm-hmm. Special place in all of our hearts, I think.
Totally. And what I really loved from a specific alien perspective is that, you know, it literally gave the idea of an alien organism on the show that's kind of humanoid form. It gave it teeth.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it was a real horror moment for the show. It was a real for the film. It was a really terrifying character design. It looked incredible. I'm a big fan of, you know, creature design.
Mm-hmm.
It was original, but it was familiar in terms of it being, you know, gray-esque, but with those talons and just its ferocity. Just when that thing was born, it was ready to go. I'm ready. Here I am, and I'm hungry, and I don't care what's in front of me. I'm gonna be the alpha predator, and boom. And I think that the film didn't get enough props for even that detail alone. That it presented an alien organism in a fresh way all over again. And we'd already had the embarrassment of riches of what the show had done, but to this point anyway, especially with things like the black oil. But it's but to go fleshy and gooey and teethy and claws and be really scary and commit to that 100%, genius.
Yeah. That's a really good point, and agreed completely. Mm. You've brought up the props that you got or that you used. How many of those were actual props from the show, and how many did you have to make up from, like, just make up?
Most of them are from the show, which is a great ratio to be able to reveal. This was a really fascinating process, though, because you can have a wish list, you can have a shopping list until the cows come home. But is that a phrase you guys say in America? Until the cows come home?
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes my British vernacular kind of trips me up. And I go, they won't have a clue what I've just said.
No, we love it.
But so sending that to the Fox Archives team as a starting point, that was really what it was about. And the rules, again, not to overstate this, but when you watch an episode of The X-Files, you see a lot of stuff on the screen. But I had to commit to what would Mulder and Scully be aware of? What did they touch? What was involved with the case? For a lot of stuff is really cool for ideas for props, but wouldn't ever be part of this case file. So you kind of push all that to one side. This is the in-world stuff. Okay. And then you say to the Fox Archives team, does it still exist? Because, you know, back in the 90s, things were thrown in boxes, shoved in drawers, because why would they think of doing anything like this, you know, back then when the show is just growing, becoming a popular show? So that was the starting point. And then the Fox Archives team took that wish list and through their databases, which are vast and incredible, came back with the report of, we think we've got most of this stuff.
Wow.
Oh my God. Okay. That's already an oh my God moment as a fan. And then what happened was, it was a few trips to different offices, one to the kind of more admin side of the offices. But my favorite trip was to this kind of like secret location, aircraft hangar style building. I mean, we've all seen big buildings, but this was kind of, it was big in such a specific way that it was so wide and basically like an aircraft hangar with all these different floors and levels, that when I got to my designated level, the way I describe it actually is a combination of things. You know, the power loader sort of escape scene in Aliens which she gets to that station on the, actually no, scrub that. It's not the power loader scene at the end on the back in space, the actual infrastructure on LV-46.
I just watched that movie two nights ago. FYI.
So when she's trying to escape and it's the how many floors, the sense of the amount of floors you get in the infrastructure of that
building. It's just going and going and going and going. Yeah.
That's the first thing that came to mind when I went into the work elevator. It was, how big is this building? It just keeps going. And then you come out on the floor and your neck just goes up and up and up and up. And all you can see is, well, they could fit three planes in here, on top of each other. And the boxes and the boxes and all the temperature control boxes. And it's not just for... It's not just for X-Files. It's for all these other companies. And
did you see the smoking man in there? Because
that's exactly what it felt like. It was a collision between that and that the scale of that building and the end of Raiders. Of course, comes to mind. But that was a really special day because we had the kind of directive of, we think that these old dusty boxes, which I can't overstate, they hadn't been opened in over 20, 25 years. I hadn't seen oxygen. They'd just been sealed. And so it was a game of, we have all this information which suggests this stuff that exists and suggests that it's in these boxes, but nobody knows. And so I'm very carefully going through these boxes. And that's when, you know, your fan brain is just, you know, your work brain is back at home.
And my brain is blowing up and I wasn't even there. So
yeah, me too.
And you're just going, oh my, and you're ticking them off. You're going, yeah, we have that. Oh my God, we have this. And then you find the stuff you didn't know that you were looking for.
Right.
But you go, oh, okay, that was on the super wish list. Like they're never going to have that. But oh yeah, they have the dental scan from the Shapes episode. Oh my God, they have that. Yeah. And things like, you know, Chuck's the aura photography slice of
Leonard Bett's head. Yeah.
I was holding that.
Oh my God.
And you're going, you know, and you just, and just little details like that, and you're going, this is crazy. And then of course, in and among the episodes that I needed, there's all this other stuff from the other episodes. And I kept getting distracted going, my God, look at this from the Syndicate mythology episode. Look at this from this other Monster of the Week episode we don't need to look at. But I just would spend a few minutes just leafing through it going, oh my God. But the really fun thing about that process is that a lot of the paper was compressed. And so folders upon folders were really, really smushed everything down. And this happened a bunch of times where I didn't think we had it. And then you'd look at it and go, wait, that looks like it's kind of, and you kind of very carefully sort of tease the two pages apart. And then in between is a police report, which, you know, things like, oh my God, there's so many examples of it. But anything, all the police report matter that you see in the book, stuff like that, that's just, you know, smushed in between pages. So it really was that level of investigations into the archive to find this stuff. But then, of course, to answer your question fully, is that, yes, of course, there were things we had to recreate. And there were things like things that appeared on computer screens that, in my mind, to the context of the case file, well, you know, Scully would have hit print and just printed out a copy of that reference to things like the flutes in real life. But again, we had to make sure that the printout was of the same kind of paper would be at that time, the toner, the way the toner would be displayed on the paper, because you got to get it right, guys. You know, you got to get it right. And then the third layer to that was an opportunity to add new things that didn't ever exist as paper props that really felt like they added a lot to the narrative or to the actual case file itself. A couple of good examples of that were in the Chupacabra episode. I love the idea that, you know, that episode has got so many layers to it, but a lot of it is about storytelling and about how people can tell stories to one another and how that sort of the whispers can get distorted slightly and how you can interpret stories. And I love the idea that the end of the case file, there was a couple of newspaper articles that utilized components from the show as though someone had taken a photograph of the brothers, maybe caught them at the side of the road, and written this article about them, about the myth of the Chupacabra. So things like that sort of expanded the world slightly. Or another example, the Chimera episode, where it was such a tragic case file in many respects that this poor woman didn't really understand what's happening to her, didn't really understand that she had this whole other form, physical form and kind of dark creature side to her. And what I loved about those moments is that there's a kind of open-ended quality to the case for the first part. But then you go, well, we should try and figure out a way of addressing the creature of it all in the room, because if you don't, it's not a very exciting case file to look through. And the fact that she was committed to, you know, a psychiatric place for observation and for studying to see, you know, whether she would ever fully recover from this experience. Again, we had these wonderful photographs of the all the makeup tests and things.
Yeah.
And
it was creepy.
And again, I thought, well, like so many of these great moments in the show, you get this sense that not the experiments, but the studying being done of these people that have these biological anomalies, that maybe there were glimpses where they were able to capture something about that, the side of her which Mulder saw. And again, as fans, we witnessed it. And so I think it's framed in the case file in a very specific way, that it was a fragment of a moment that they could capture. You know, photography or security cameras, I forget the specifics of it, managed to capture her form to prove that she has this very strange aspect to her physical form. And I just felt that was really important to the fans, to honour the creature of it all, the monster of the week moments, but make sure that it exists again in an in-world way that makes sense.
Yeah, a lot of these things got proven in a way through photographs, but even things that Scully didn't see, for example. Like, and so that's kind of an interesting thing that you bring up. Like, a lot of these, at a certain point, you're like, okay, well, can we stop pretending this isn't real? Because it's real. Here it is. Here's a picture of it. Or like, this is the report from like three different witnesses, and here it is. It's almost like you are Layla Harrison and you're trying to be like, look, you guys, take this stuff seriously. And I actually I really like that some of her notes reflect that.
Thank you.
Who's writing is all of that, by the way? Who's handwriting?
I never found out the name of the person, because they went through a few different handwriting people who do this for a living, actually do full handwriting. That was a very specific thing. I have to ask the designers about it. That's in the crazy sort of maelstrom of making the book. You see the handwriting come in and you go, oh, that's really cool.
Yeah.
That was a really, again, a specific detail that a lot of publishers, to give Abrams a lot of credit, would have gone, well, let's use a handwriting style font. And again, I was adamant, if it was possible, to go, you cannot land that in authenticity with a book like this. The fans are going to just eat you alive for that. But they found that the handwriting is great. It really feels like it's her doing the handwriting. And it's a really good choice by them. But you're right about the anomalies. And I think I was acutely aware of the cases where that felt the most genuine to have that addressed.
Yeah.
Things like the Lucky Boy case, because
you have a body. Yeah.
We have a body, and it wasn't like the Alone case where it returns to a human form. And, you know, and I love how clever that episode is constructed, that Doggett can't see. So Doggett doesn't really see the kind of creature form, but, with Rob, there's a body, it's there, and he's masking, you know, he's in his humanoid form with who he really is, but it's there, the body's there. So I wanted to kind of honor those moments, and just, again, it all comes from the show. I'm not really imposing anything. It's more paying attention to the show in a different way, responding to the rules of the show, how is it leaving the case files open and stuff like that. And then you can have fun with with things like the lightning episode, where you can have that character. I love that we came up with that he's got this personality where he won't allow himself to be shown with an ID photograph, so he just electrically burns everything. Every photograph that is taken, just going to burn it. It's going to burn it, because it's like, that's exactly what he would do.
It makes sense.
Yeah. It's just fun.
So cool.
God, that's so many characters that you had to sort of get into the heads of. That's amazing. I love it.
Yeah.
Well, Jen, if you have some more questions, please feel free to bring them up. But I had just one more thing I wanted to bring up in terms of like something kind of that was added to the canon that I found very interesting. Mm-hmm. And that was part of your I Want to Believe reports. Because you had some really cool aftermath letters. Like, you had one from Mulder that was sort of, you know, implying, hey, well, you know, if this is all okay, please don't talk to me again, sort of like the idea that, hey, we're cool now, but we're not gonna be buddies. Like, and then the idea that in Scully's letter she mentions that the boy survived and was actually doing really well with his treatments, which I found really, I mean, and Chris obviously said that, right? Like, Chris said the boy survived, because I feel like that was such a huge mystery of that movie. And so for him to like land on an answer, I found very fascinating.
Well, I think the letter says something like he's doing well. Like,
or he's responding to the treatment or whatever. Yeah.
So I never wanted to, with moments like that, I never wanted to do anything definitive about where the future lies with the character. But right. I felt like those two specific moments, I'm glad you brought them up, because that film it's such an emotionally weighty film, especially with what Mulder and Scully go through with their relationship and with each other and individually, with struggling with faith and how that responds to the case.
Yeah.
And that just felt like the right thing to add to that particular case file, again, because otherwise there's going to be a ton of really cool props from that film, again, which had a kind of parapsychic phenomena quality to it. But Mulder specifically, I think, as you say, doubling down on going, yeah, look, okay, I've contributed to this, but you know, we're done. Mm-hmm. That felt very honest with him as a character. And just again, I wanted, I'm kind of hinting at another Easter egg, which you may have spotted, but the letter that Dana writes, there's a quote at the top of the letter, which is an Easter egg to the movie. So if you go back and look at what the quote is from the letter, there's a very specific nod back to something that happens in the film.
But yeah, on her letter?
Yes. It just felt like a very... It added emotion to the case file, and it just felt like the right thing to do, that's how that would be addressed. Because, you know, agents died and they were involved with this case. And it's almost like it would make perfect sense for them to contribute to almost like the wrapping up of this very dark, twisted, series of peculiar Frankenstein events. But I'm glad you thought they were worthy to in the voices of the characters, they added something to that.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to find what you're talking about later when I have more time to sort of sift through this. But yeah, I loved the idea, because that the boy, because the you know, that ending, the idea of not giving up and the idea of pushing forward, I think was just really powerful, a really powerful message. And so the idea that her not giving up on this boy and then it actually working, like it actually having the outcome that she was hoping for when we didn't know that before, I think is a really hopeful, positive outcome. So I enjoyed reading that. So
thank you. I think that, as you say, the don't give up, you know, the key phrase in the film. And I think that I definitely wanted, for such a, you know, especially when you're presenting case file material that is very dark and is pretty graphic and, you know, and you know, some disturbing stuff in the case files, of course, because the show is an adult show. And there's a lot of grim things in there. But yeah, I definitely wanted to make sure that, again, there was an echo of how the characters exit the film, that there is, as I say, there is a degree of hope to the situation. And it felt like it would be an empty case file and very odd to have Harrison find all this material, but then, you know, our beloved Mulder and Scully, who were involved with this case, that got the kind of like they got thrown into it, to not have them address something in an authentic way wouldn't have been right, I don't think.
Yeah. Mm. Well, like you said, I think without it, it's the heart of the show. And so we needed those Absolutely. Things. And so it was really nice to see them in here.
Absolutely.
I wanted to go through some sort of lightning round questions with you here. But before I do that, Jen, did you have anything else that you wanted to ask Paul?
I'm just curious about, I'm kind of a Layla Harrison fan. And so I'm curious about sort of how you sort of landed on her as almost kind of like, she's almost like the narrator of the story. She's the one who's guiding us through all these files. Was that something you sort of envisioned from the beginning, or how did you sort of come to that idea?
That's a really great question. So there was always a kind of a gist of how I knew this wasn't going to be, or I didn't want it to be, a very dry collection of case files. I wanted, as you say, to have some kind of connective tissue, some kind of narrative that kind of holds all together. And when I started to think about, well, Harrison would be the right person in terms of the timeline of the show. And it really was a couple of very sort of, you know, serendipitous things that occurred. So if we get the timeline up again for a second, the timeline. So I'm pitching the idea in 2015, season 10 has been announced. But fast forwarding to when I'm actually really in the guts of writing, making the book, which is really end of 2017 into 2018 and beyond. As a fan, you know, I'm watching the show, I'm watching season 11. And then there's that moment where Skinner reveals that this, you know, nefarious organization company were tasked to digitize the X-Files, make them available on a system, on an online system, all digitized, can be accessed anywhere. And it was a few things. It was the way that Mitch performed that sequence. There is this kind of like frustration and mm-hmm. upset that he was even forced to do that. And it was literally in the midst of me writing a lot of getting the sense of the case files, getting a sense of how it would work in the book. And when I saw that sequence, it literally was like a lightning rod moment. It went, oh, hang on a second. So if we rewind a second to the end of season 9, and essentially Mulder and Scully are gone and the X-Files are closed, and that's you know, stated as well when the show comes back in season 10, that what if this proposal began maybe in just conversations, that maybe a word was bantered around of a company that will be tasked to do this, maybe because he is loyal, ultimately he wants to protect Mulder and Scully's work, which again it was lovely to see in the Kitten episode how much he really loved and respected their work, and all these little serendipitous things were clicking into place beautifully, and I was going, yes, Skinner would do this. he would come up with this concept, and just the idea that Agent Harrison becoming Special Agent, and that him saying to her, which is that for listeners who haven't got the book, there's a letter at the very front of the book where Skinner, and it's dated in 2002. And as a very quick sidebar, pay attention to a lot of the other dates in the book, because when I say there are Easter eggs all the way through this book, there are Easter eggs everywhere. Mm-hmm. So even when you see September 10th, 2002, maybe have a think about the significance of September 10th and things like that. So there's Easter eggs everywhere. But I love this idea in my head of Skinner, again, away from his superiors, going, no way. Like this doesn't feel right. And the only person who I really feel like, because, you know, it says in the letter that Doggett and Reyes are, you know, that they're not around, they've been reassigned. The only person he feels he can trust, who has that kind of the plucky attitude, the absolute obsession with Mulder and Scully's work because she respects it so deeply, she would be the one, and also would be the one who no one would suspect of being involved with such an operation.
She is us.
She is us, 100%. And so, and of course, you know, honoring, you know, the dear fan who's the character's named after as well. And it had all these different layers to it that just felt like it was, as you say, representing the viewer, the spirit of that feeling, being the narrator, being the investigator through the case files, just felt absolutely right. And once I had that in my head, I couldn't think of anybody else. I couldn't figure out a different agent. Or, you know, someone said to me the other day, oh, why don't you just make up an agent? And I said, why would you? There's Layla Harrison. Like, why would you make up a name where that's crazy?
Yeah.
So the idea did evolve, but it really was solidified by just the fluke. I didn't know what was coming up in the show. Just having Skinner explain that in this episode of season 11, it just felt, okay, maybe it feels like there's more history to this moment for him as a character. And and it was, and again, I'm just imprinting this all on the moment because this wasn't told to me. This is just me trying to be creative with the book. But it did feel like there was many layers to what he was explaining to them. So maybe this is what he was trying to hide, not show his hand in that moment.
I love that you're giving that moment, like a little bit more heft and a little bit more backstory than maybe they had intended even when they wrote it. So, I mean, that's really amazing.
It does, and it does fit.
Just inspired from the show. I mean, I think anything like this, when you're doing an official book of any kind, if it's especially if it's in-world, or if you're doing making ofs or art of books, but if you are committing to doing an in-world book, you have to go to the source, go back to that well every time, and try and be inspired by what's happening on the show, just to make things click together and create a narrative framework that I think that hopefully the fans feel honors, you know, the emotional journey of all those characters.
Yeah, well, I certainly did. I think it was awesome.
For sure. Definitely. Well,
this is so much fun, Paul. Thanks so much for coming on. But before we say goodbye, I just have some quick lightning round questions for you.
Okay.
All right, you ready?
I as ready as I can. I'm always terrified by a lightning round.
Okay.
No, you'll do fine.
There's no wrong answers.
Oh, that's what we did.
No. It's not trivia. I promise. It's just.
I thought it was going to be Who Wants to Be a Millionaire style.
No.
We could do that.
No, these are just you questions. Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. What is your all-time favorite episode?
Oh man, I knew you were going to ask that. I took a sip of my tea and I thought it's coming. Here comes the all-time favorite. I really struggle to pick one out of the 218 episodes and the movies, but one that always fills me with delight when I think about it in terms of every aspect of the episode is Bad Blood. I know that's kind of an obvious choice of many people, but for me it's about more than just being a great X-Files episode. I love the whole construction of that as a piece of storytelling. I love the unreliable narrator. I don't think it's ever been bettered in how two established characters in a show, at that point in a show's run, that you do that episode. And I think you can only do that episode when we've all lived with the characters for years and then you land that sucker.
Absolutely. I am there with you, but should I out you, Jen? Should I out you?
Go ahead.
Jen hates Bad Blood.
Sorry.
it's emotionally honest response to anything that's on TV or films. If you just don't get it, that's totally fine.
Yeah,
I get it. Sort of. I can see why people like it. I just don't.
That's totally fine.
Fair.
The only other thing I'll say to corroborate my love of it is, I can't think of a better cold open where in the show where I remember as a fan watching it with a friend of mine at college. And as the titles rolled, we both just had this look in our face of, well, he's screwed. Like, there's no way he's going to get out of this. He's killed a teenager and revealed that they aren't real fangs. They're fake.
Yeah.
He literally killed a kid. Yeah. He's going to be put away for murder. Yeah. And the fact that whoever in the process of writing the episode, but that particular cold open choice to then go into the insanity and the hilarity of the unreliable narrators, and then to almost when you think there's still no way out for Mulder, because it's all he thinks that, but then I just love the fact that they go back and then Skinner's like, no, you need to go back.
Yeah, it's like everything doesn't matter. We're starting over.
There's something really iffy about this. And then I think again, it was almost like a deconstruction of the vampire as a creature, as an episode. But honestly, maybe on a different day I'd pick a different thing. But I just live in the moment when I think, what am I thinking right now that I really love? Yeah. And Bad Blood always pops up in there with a bunch of other ones. But as we established earlier, the mythology as a whole and their relationship and all the almost moments, that's probably my favorite stuff about the show is Dim, Mulder and Scully.
We love that too.
Favorite monster?
Oh, that's a great one. Great question. I'm jumping between a few that I really, really love. I think on sheer visceral terror, because I think some of the best monster of the week episodes are the ones that just get you on a really visceral level. the Foley Adieu episode.
Ooh.
I hate all cockroach crickets and stuff. they really get under my skin in a you know, just completely rational way because they're tiny. But when that episode aired, again, the opening, I just thought, oh, man, I'm not going to do well with this one. I'm watching this in the dark.
In the sound. I remember that. Yeah.
The sound design was brilliant. The jittering.
Yeah.
It's a really underrated episode overall.
Agreed.
I think that it's
really
stellar episode. I love the way, I love the construction of it. Again, as a piece of storytelling, the fact that poor Mulder, what happens to him? But again, you think, what would Skinner have no choice? It's like,
yeah.
They can't tear him down. But again, it's unresolved. I love the fact that I've got a big love of you know, creature features and stuff like that, that do that well-trodden territory of the coda, the kind of epilogue moment of, ooh, is the creature still out there? I love the ending of Foley Adieu so much they do that, that again in the book I had some fun with that and did some Easter egg moments to that whole experience that happens in the very ending of the episode. So I think that's a good creature choice.
That's great. That's a great answer. I wouldn't have thought of that as my number one, but that's a
great
really
one.
Good suggestion. I'm going to start using it. I'm going to steal that.
It is
that
creepy.
It's my favorite monster.
I want to turn the tables just quickly, but so what are your favorite monsters, both of you?
Oh, I really like that one.
That one is good. Oh, I'm trying to remember what we picked when we did our top 10 monsters. That was so long ago.
I tend to pick more often the monsters that are like humans but have like monstrous qualities, like you know, in the episode, like Pusher and that's the kind of sort of bad guy that I tend to go for more than sort of the monsters, although that monster in Foley Adieu is really cool actually. So
honestly,
that is a really good answer.
This is probably not my answer, but honorable mention is the Jackson monster in Ghoulie. I think that one is incredible looking.
Great design.
Awesome looking monster. Scary. Yeah. Really good.
Really good.
Okay, this one's really hard. You ready?
Uh-oh. I need more tea. Yep.
Okay. Is that an X-Files mug?
It is. Just for you guys.
Please. I've been wondering the whole time.
Love
it's
it.
Beautiful.
Love it.
It's like looks trees and there's an X. It's gorgeous.
It looks like my phone case. I think it's the same thing.
Yeah, from the Fox store. Yeah. So
Yeah.
I need to get my hands on that, I think. Yeah.
It's really good.
It's a good
All
one.
Right.
I like it.
You ready for our hard question? It's really hard.
Okay.
Yeah. Mulder or Scully?
Don't do it. Don't upset me. Come on. Well, I thought we all had a thing. We had an understanding that
thought we were friends.
They're everything. Oh man, that's mean. Do you do that to all your guests? You make them pick one of the two.
Oh yeah, these we give to all of our guests.
We've done it ourselves too.
Mm-hmm.
You know what?
Many people have taken a powder on this question, Paul, so it's okay.
I mean, how can one exist in the mind of your lovely fan without the other? I'm going to be really cheeky and say that they come as such a unit, as a pair. I will say this, that is totally dodging your in a politician way, totally dodging your question. But I thought what doesn't get talked about a lot about Scully is that the way the pilot is constructed and presented to us as viewers is that Scully is the anchor of the show. Mm-hmm. It's her show. It's actually her. You see her first. She gets sent to the X-Files office. She meets Mulder. And even how that case plays out, that it's really Scully's show. You know,
it's through her eyes. Yeah.
Before we even really got a sense of the duo of it all, of Mulder and Scully. So I would just say that.
Okay, fair. You know,
it's a very thorough answer. I like it.
The huge caveat is that we all know that we love them the same. This is meant to be a difficult question. So,
yeah, I think you'd have been disturbed and surprised if I immediately picked one without taking a pause and going, oh, and here's why. I think you'd go, oh, this guy's plumbed.
Well, it's a good answer. I liked your politician evasiveness.
Yeah, no,
I think it worked.
Fair.
It was effective.
Yeah, well, we all agree. So,
this is an interesting one. Monster of the week or mythology?
You know, I'm going to probably throw a lot of fans here, and I'm going to say mythology for a very specific reason. Whenever I think about that word in terms of the show, I don't even really think about the mythology as in the alien conspiracy and the syndicate and all of that jazz. I actually think about the overarching story of Mulder and Scully, because Mm-hmm. Although the Monster of the Week episodes do capture so many great things about their relationship and how it develops, there's so much meaty, weighty, important emotional stuff that the overarching storyline is how I think I'd like to term it, does all the heavy lifting. And all the stuff about Scully missing and the abduction and coming back to Mulder and the cancer and everything. Mulder being abducted. There's just so much that creates this wonderful drama and peril and tension and affection between them as characters that's the thing. It's almost like if people said to me in a similar question, do you watch The X-Files to watch the Monster of the Week episodes, or do you watch it for their overall relationship over the entire show over 11 seasons? And it's like, well, it's the second one. Like I watch it to watch their relationship play out on screen and how that is affected by the cases they investigate. So,
oh, that's the perfect answer. You sold me.
Yeah, I love that. That you really perfectly articulated there what I like about the mythology episodes too, because I would tend to say mythology too, but aliens are cool, but you've really nailed it that it's because the mythology tends to be sort of the medium by which we see Mulder and Scully's relationship the most. And so
that's
a really great point. Yeah. Love it.
Well, I think I know the answer to this next one. I hope. Platonic partners or soulmates?
Soulmates? Oh, I'm not even going to hesitate.
Yes.
What kind of crazy person says platonic? Like
I love it.
Be surprised.
I love it.
Soulmates. Nice. Come on.
Absolutely.
That is the right answer. I mean, I said there were no right answers, but that's the right answer.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we could spend hours talking about the reasons and the evidence to, to such things. But there's so many moments. And another episode that I don't think gets enough sort of being singled out as being great pieces of storytelling in the show is Gillian's episode, is All Things. Mm-hmm. In terms of it's a really poignant episode. I love the way we talked about music earlier and soundtrack. I love the way that song is used as a kind of hypnotic kind of a sense memory callback. And I just think it just has such a delightful ending that I don't even think we see coming the way they by happenstance or because they're soulmates that's kind of was always going to happen. But there's so many Hammer. It's endless. There's so many great, again, the almost moments. That's my favorite stuff about the show. Almost moments equals soulmates. There you go.
I was not expecting you to be such a shipper. I'm so pleasantly surprised. I must say.
This is really on brand for us. So we're thrilled.
Excellent.
Well, thank you so much for coming on, Paul. Other than the book, which everyone listening needs to go out and purchase, is there anything else that you'd like to plug?
Hey, I came on the show on your great show to chat X-Files. So I'm not here to plug. I'm here just to have a conversation with, you know, fellow X-Files fans. And then just, enjoy talking about the show and enjoy talking about what we love about the show. And I can't thank you enough for having me on. And I really appreciate all your comments and your insights and what you feel the book gives you as fans and as readers. And the fact that you feel that it's a worthy experience for a fan to go through. I can't ask more than that. If anyone has an emotional connection to this book, then I've done my job. That's all I need.
Awesome. Well, amazing. I should actually say the title of the book because I don't think I have said it, even though we're going to tweet the crap out of it. The X-Files, the Official Archives, Cryptids, Biological Anomalies, and Parapsychic Phenomena. And you can get it on Amazon, I believe. That's where I got mine. So
that's where I got mine.
Everybody, as I say, it's available wherever you like to get your books. I always say that because, again, a lot of people go, is it just exclusive to a few territories or, you know, countries? No, wherever you like to get your books, call them up, email them, walk in, socially distance, be careful, be safe. But just find out where, local bookstores are great to support as well during these times. It's some great local bookstores we have in LA. I'm sure, you know, where you live in Canada, there's wonderful bookstores too. So wherever you want to grab it, I hope they have it in stock. That's my hope because it's been a little worrying seeing the, it's exciting, but it's worrying seeing the stock going out of stock going, oh, I want people to get this book.
Yeah. No, I was able to get mine without too much difficulty. So
Yeah. And I mean, again, the more people buy this book, the more likely we're going to get another one, and which we all should want and need. So
that's the goal here.
Fingers crossed.
Maybe there's hope. Well, thanks again, Paul.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's been really lovely chatting to you.
Thanks for listening. And we will be back with you guys in a couple weeks for another episode of X-Files Diaries.
Bye.
Thank you.